I'm going to ask Larry to light two candles for us this morning. The first is to honor the life of longtime church member Yvonne Bondarchuk, who died on Wednesday, January 25th. Yvonne co-founded with Donna Greenberg the Jammers, the joyful association of music makers who bring heartwarming songs to retirement homes and care facilities. A service to honor Yvonne's life will be held on March 4th, officiated by Christopher Wolf, our ministerial intern. We invite you to sign a card at the back on the care and concern table for Yvonne's 5 children. We light a second candle to honor the life of another longtime church member, Menno Trump, who died on Tuesday morning, January 31st. Menno had been in hospitals and rehab for a year and a half and was just about to move back home when he suffered a sudden brain aneurysm. Sherry and their family were able to be with him and hold him through the end. Menno's memorial service will be held on Saturday, February 25th at 2 p.m., officiated by Reverend Shauna. We invite you to sign the card at the back of the sanctuary for Sherry and their 3 sons. This is part of what church is for, to hold each other through these milestones of life and death. I have one more announcement along these lines, this time a birth. On Saturday, January 28th, Sarah Mae, Ryan, and their son Gabriel welcomed into this world a new baby, Alexander Robert Marley Adam. Remarkably, they are here in person today. Oh, squishy baby. There is a card for them on the back of the care and concern table as well. All are invited to add your name to welcome little Alex. Now I'm going to change the order of things a bit. First, I would like to welcome forward our honored volunteer, Mike Thiebiger-Crossman, to light our chalice. Several times a year, our awards and recognition team asks a different council to nominate someone for this honor. Mike was nominated by the Property Council in recognition of his beautiful work and tireless effort over the years constructing various landscaping designs on our church grounds. You can read all about it and his wee companion Jocko in the February newsletter. For now, as he kindles the flame of our faith, let us give thanks for the ways in which he and so many others quietly go about doing the work that keeps our congregation going. Blessed be. This month's theme is love and justice. The words were taken from the new vision of our national organization, the Canadian Unitarian Council. UU congregations across the country, including our own, participated in creating this vision. Larry and I will read the statement as our opening words. As Canadian Unitarian Universalists, we envision a world in which our interdependence calls us to love and justice.
As Canadian Unitarian Universalists, 7 principles guide our choices. 6 sources nourish our spirits. 5 aspirations help us grow.
As Canadian Unitarian Universalists, we aspire to be
deeply connected.
We strive to foster healthy relationships amongst and within UU communities with the broader world and all of life.
Radically inclusive.
We strive to create hospitable, diverse, multi-generational communities.
Actively engaged.
We strive to work joyfully for a just and compassionate society, experimenting with new forms of community.
Theologically alive.
We seek to be ever evolving in our understanding open to new knowledge.
Spiritually grounded.
We seek transformation through personal spiritual experiences and shared ritual. The work of love and justice is not easy, but it can be rich and rewarding if we bring to it our open minds, open hearts, and earnest striving. So this is truly a message for all ages. I'm talking to everybody in this congregation today. Many of you have heard that a week ago, on the other side of the country in Quebec City, a man walked into a mosque and attacked Muslim people who were there to pray. 6 were killed, 19 were injured. This made Muslim people all over Canada scared, and it made Canadians all over Canada sad. We are a country that cherishes diversity. We want people of all different cultures and all different religions to feel safe and welcome here. In the days that followed the attack, there were vigils all across the country. People of all faiths and no faith gathered together to express our sadness and show the Muslim community that we stand with them. In Victoria on Monday, people left flowers and messages of support on the steps of the local mosque on Quadra Street. And on Tuesday, nearly 3,000 people gathered for a vigil at City Hall. The Times columnist interviewed a Muslim woman from Libya who now lives in Victoria and was at the vigil. She said that after Sunday's shooting, she was so afraid she thought of not leaving the house. But the article said, after seeing the huge turnout and show of support for the Muslim community in front of Victoria City Hall, her fear turned to hope. She said, quote, I feel the support. I feel I am secure. I feel I am home. I can see the love in people's eyes. I believe in Victorian people. They are warm, open-minded. The man in the picture who's speaking to the crowd is the imam, the religious leader of the mosque on Quadra Street. At the vigil, Imam Nur said, regardless of one's nationality, we are one community. We live in a time when people try so very hard to divide us, but it only brings us closer and makes us stronger. He urged us to continue to fight Islamophobia, which is prejudice against Muslim people, to continue to fight Islamophobia through education and communication. Reverend Shauna sent a message to Imam Nur on behalf of our congregation. You can see what the imam looks like a little better in this photo. Reverend Shauna wrote, dear Imam, we are writing on behalf of the entire congregation of the First Unitarian Church of Victoria to express our heartfelt sense of solidarity with your community. We recognize that the violence in Quebec City is but the most recent expression of a rising tide of Islamophobia in North America. We do not accept the negative image of Muslims being espoused by many. We offer ourselves as willing participants in any efforts or events your community might sponsor to uplift healing and understanding and respect in Victoria. Please do not hesitate to call upon us if we can offer our presence or voices to any such event or occasion. With prayers for enduring peace, Reverends Melora and Shauna Lingood, co-ministers, Lorna Anthony, congregational president. Imam Nur responded with this message. Greetings, Reverend Shauna. Thank you so very much. It really means a lot to me personally and to the Muslim community here in Victoria. The support has been overwhelming. Words can't describe the sense of relief many people here feel now due to the solidarity shown. Islamophobia is real, but we can combat it together. Thank you once again. Sincerely, Ismail Mohammed Nur. Our theme this month is love and justice. This is one way we can work toward love and justice. We can stand up against hate, violence, prejudice, and racism. We build those bridges between our divisions, reaching out to one another in love, affirmation, and support. To close, I'm wondering if I can get 6 volunteers to light candles for each of the 6 people who were killed last week. Raise your hand if you're willing to light a candle. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Thank you. Come on forward. Take a candle and light. Come on in here. I light a final candle for hope and healing. May we do all that we can to help our Muslim brothers, sisters, and siblings to feel safe and welcome in our shared home. Thank you for listening.
I'd like to invite Sonia to come up for our SRC moment.
Good morning. The 7 UU principles speak to our ideals and hopes. This month, the Share the Plate recipient for the first and last Sunday is the Unitarian Service Committee, now known as USC Canada, chosen as a responsive action to our collective support for the interdependent web of all existence and justice, equity, and compassion. Through its Seeds for Survival program, USC works in the international community to promote family farms and build strong rural communities. It collaborates with others to preserve healthy ecosystems around the world. With engaged Canadians and partners in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, the USC supports programs, training, and policies that strengthen biodiversity, food sovereignty, and the rights of those at the heart of resilient food systems, women, indigenous peoples, and small-scale farmers. Here are some of their own words about their mission. At USC, our work stems from the universal values of equality, justice, peace, and dignity of all human beings. To focus our efforts, we apply the principles of rights, resilience, and respect. These values are central to our work. Respect for our global heritage helps us value the diverse experiences to which we all contribute. Only then can we recognize common cause and work towards those goals as equals. The challenge is to develop partnerships based on mutual respect, power sharing, and a common vision. The kind of development we envision holds that people are the agents of their own change. An important aspect of food security is ensuring diversity and free availability of seeds. Major corporations are increasingly attempting to patent seeds and restrict choices to their own limited and often genetically modified products. Locally, we can help by saving our own seeds and supporting events such as the Seedy Saturdays and encourage saving and trading. Victoria's Seedy Saturday takes place this year on February 18th from 10 to 4 p.m. in the Victoria Conference Center downtown. There is a seed exchange as well as sales of many kinds of seeds, seedlings, and plants. USC Canada started way back in 1945 as the Unitarian Service Committee, founded by energetic Dr. Lotta Hitchmanova. Its members are still planting the seeds that Lotta sowed. Please help this important work as you are able. As we unite, the world unites. Thank you.
Let's remain seated and join together in singing our meditative hymn, followed by a minute of silent reflection and prayer. Breathe in, breathe out.
Have you ever had a conversation with someone that completely changed your outlook on a topic or an issue? I've shared with you in the past that I volunteer at Our Place. How I ended up volunteering there began right here in this sanctuary when Reverend Al Tissick spoke about his work, and I felt he issued a challenge to join him in his rounds at 5:30 a.m., waking up the homeless in our city. When I was considering volunteering at Our Place, I spoke with a close friend of mine of my desire to do this. He emphatically stated that there was no way that he would consider going near Our Place. He spoke of his impression of drug addicts hanging around on the boulevard and about not wanting to be around those people. I must admit, I kind of had similar concerns, but I had attended the orientation session and with some trepidation, decided to see for myself and to form my own opinion. So off I went to my first shifts. I was warned to use only one washroom because the one nearest to where I worked may have addicts using needles in them. Of course, this warning served only to reinforce my friend's opinion. However, during my third shift, everything changed. I served coffee and cake to a lady in her early to mid-70s. Who was clearly not a drug addict. This was a slow evening, so I could go and sit with her for a few minutes. We chatted about many things, such as current events and local history. It turns out that she had written a few children's books, was married for many years, and was now a widow. I asked her why she came to Our Place. She replied that she survives on basic pensions. And after paying her rent, utilities, and miscellaneous bills, she has little left over for groceries. She was coming to our place where she could get a hot meal and some company. We talked at length about the many people that our place helps, such as seniors on a limited fixed income like her, the working poor, those who make minimum wage and struggle to get by that need a hot meal, people who live on the streets, and people who struggle with the disease of addiction, among many others. Thanks to this wonderful lady, I now have a completely different outlook on our place and the people they serve, and just how we are all a part of our interdependent web of life. Have you ever had a conversation with someone that completely changed your outlook on a topic or issue?
Working for justice is hard enough when we agree on what just action is. But what happens when we don't agree? We all want, for example, peace in the Middle East or a sustainable planet. What happens when you and I have different ideas about how to best achieve those goals? Or what happens if I think the issue is complex and I'm not sure which methods are best? What happens when justice is not clear to everyone? Our congregations are supposed to be places where we can think this stuff through and work it out together. We share a common goal. Our interdependence calls us to love and justice. We are supposed to be able to come here and share different ideas about how to do that. We're supposed to be able to share our feelings and experiences and talk through different options and opinions, all held in the sanctuary of love and respect. But we are human, subject to human foibles and failings, and sadly, we don't always manage to do this very well. Sometimes we get so entrenched in an I'm right, you're wrong position that we say hurtful things to one another. Maybe you have been in an argument like this at church or with friends or coworkers or extended family. Someone implies that if you disagree with them, you must be stupid or uncaring or both. Or maybe you thought the same about someone else. Have you ever inwardly ranted, "How can they be so dumb? Don't they care?" There's a special brand of this kind of insult that I've witnessed in our congregations. We wield the seven principles like bludgeons. If someone disagrees with us on a particular issue, we accuse them of not living up to our principles. As if affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person would lead each of us to make exactly the same decision in every ethical dilemma or policy choice. Another way that we fumble is that sometimes in our congregations, we assume that since we all, Unitarian Universalists, share the same values, we must all share the same politics. And we say things that inadvertently disparage people in our midst who silently hold a different view. Other times in our congregations, when issues feel too contentious, we just avoid it altogether. This is an understandable reaction, for many of us have learned to dislike conflict. I remember when I was a university student getting into heated debates with a relative of mine about feminism and racism, nature versus nurture, the social construction of truth. I don't recall the details anymore, but I recall the feeling, the sick to my stomach, agitated feeling. I really believed that I was right, but he was a better debater than I was. So it generally felt like he won the arguments. It was so frustrating. I felt demoralized and defeated, like I'd let down my people and my cause. Around the same time, I had similar debates with a friend of mine, mostly about sexism. He persisted in referring to grown women as girls. It drove me nuts. We were better matched in debating skills, so I didn't feel quite as demoralized, but I still felt defeated. I had a sense that even though I was right, I had failed to change his opinion, so I had somehow lost. It was all so unpleasant. I can see why people would want to avoid these kinds of debates. Perhaps you have your own experiences that inform your own approach to ethical or political arguments. Do you like to delve in or run away or somewhere in between? When we first arrived in Canada, I remembered being puzzled by the odd juxtaposition of Canadian nice on the one hand, and on the other hand, the unruly way that politicians yelled at each other in Parliament. I found the political shouting storms rather alarming, but I was also not a fan of its opposite, the tight-lipped avoidance of conflict that has the effect of cutting off direct communication about things that matter. There must be another way. How can we talk about differences of opinion with compassion and respect? It makes sense that we struggle to figure this out in our congregations, for we are merely reflecting the same struggle in our larger society. As much as we progressive types say that we value diversity and want a deeper understanding of the complexity of the world and its people, we are as prone as anyone to hunkering down in our bubbles, sequestering ourselves in those social media echo chambers where every article we read and every meme we encounter on Facebook confirms our own views. Many pundits of late have been discussing how to move beyond our bubbles, how to have conversations across political or ideological divides. There's the oft-quoted Jonathan Haidt, who wrote The Righteous Mind. He says that research on the evolution of moral psychology shows us that, quote, our righteous minds were designed by evolution to unite us into teams, to divide us against other teams, and then to blind us to the truth. In other words, we are predisposed as humans to look at the world like this. On one side, you see our blessed homeland with our glorious leader, our great religion, our noble populace, and our heroic adventurers. On the other side, you have their barbaric wastes with their wicked despot, their primitive superstition, their backward savages, and their brutish invaders. It is tempting to think that we know better, and certainly we don't think of our country as one side and other countries as the other side. But when we consider how we see our own subculture, whether that's Unitarian Universalists or our own political party, whatever that party is, and then we consider how we view, say, a political leader whom we vehemently oppose and that leader's followers, I don't know. For a lot of us, it might approximate this picture. We've got the great religion. I mean, I do believe that, right? We're the great religion, and we have a noble populace. I believe that. And they are, maybe sometimes we think, backwards, with a wicked despot and primitive superstitions. Jonathan Haidt quotes Zen master Sen Tsan, if you want the truth to stand clear before you, never be for or against. The struggle for for and against is the mind's worst disease. Haidt suggests that if we want to see the whole truth, we need to step out of our own myopic view, look at it from above, and understand that each side has reasons for believing as they do. His research, which you're probably familiar with, shows that liberals and conservatives are motivated to different extents by different values. It's not that one side has values and the other doesn't. They just weight the different values differently. Both conservatives and liberals care about protection from harm and fairness. But liberals tend to give more weight to those values than do conservatives. Furthermore, conservatives also care about loyalty, authority, and purity, values that matter much less, if at all, to liberals. If we counteract moral self-righteousness with moral humility, we can see more of the truth. The person with whom we disagree is likely not stupid or lacking compassion or lacking a moral compass. They, like us, base their opinions on values. It's just that the values they prize might be different from those we choose. Once we make an effort to understand what matters to the other side, we might even be able to have a more productive conversation with them. Researcher Rob Willer gives a TED Talk about this entitled, How to Have Better Political Conversations. Willer talks about experiments they did that show that you are more likely to persuade a conservative person to agree with a particular policy if you appeal to conservative values. And likewise, you are more likely to persuade a liberal person to agree with a particular policy if you appeal to liberal values. In one study, they gave liberals and conservatives essays to read on the environment and then surveyed their opinions. One group read an essay that appealed to the liberal values of care and protection from harm. Another group read an essay that emphasized the conservative value of moral purity. It referred to pollution as disgusting and said things like, reducing pollution can help us preserve what is pure and beautiful about the places we live. As you might expect, the liberals in both groups demonstrated pro-environmental groups regardless of which essay they read. The conservatives, however, were much more swayed by the essay based on purity. It even went so far as to affect opinions on issues the essay didn't mention. The conservatives who read the essay based on purity were more likely than those who read the one based on care to say that they believed in and were concerned about global warming. Similarly, the study showed that liberals can be more readily swayed toward conservative policies if an appeal is made to the values that liberals prize most, care and fairness. Willer says that persuasion works best when it is rooted in empathy and respect. Again, we are advised to resist demonizing the other as dumb or uncaring, to instead try to understand the values that motivate their decisions. Assume that generally they, too, like you, are trying to do the right thing. I have posted a link to that TED Talk on our Facebook group, along with several others, including a UU Magazine article on political empathy, an article called The Other Side is Not Dumb, and for those of you curious about Trump supporters, an interview with Arlie Russell Hochschild, author of Strangers in Their Own Land. I must admit that there's a part of me that doesn't want to come out of my bubble. I like my echo chamber because I do feel like I'm right about a lot of this stuff. There are complex policy issues about which I'm unclear, but when it comes to the basic justice issues, like standing up for women's rights or standing in solidarity with Muslim Canadians who are targeted by Islamophobia, I do feel right. I have no desire to step out of that echo chamber. And sometimes I get so angry that there's nothing in me that wants to extend a hand across the political divide. I feel like a stubborn kid with my arms crossed against my chest. Why should I take the high road and try to understand them? They aren't trying to understand me. When I feel like this, I try to narrow the scope of my ambition. I turn my attention to our congregations. At the very least, I should be able to reach out to understand other Unitarian Universalists, united as we are by the aspirations expressed in our principles. And then I'm reminded that though we do share the same ethical goals, we don't all share the same opinions on how to achieve those goals. We have different opinions on policy and politics. There's a UU workshop that was put together a couple years ago called Beyond the Partisan Divide. It features a series of anonymous statements by real Unitarian Universalists who have struggled to feel welcome in our congregations. A Canadian said this, quote, "When asked by fellow Unitarian Universalists, I always say that I am a classical liberal, like the great Unitarian thinkers Thomas Jefferson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Henry David Thoreau. I personally identify as libertarian. I will never use the word libertarian in my congregation. In Canada, it's a four-letter word, and people think I'm either an American sympathizer or that I don't care about the poor, both of which are stereotypes and wrong. I looked for a long time thinking I had to give up things that I knew to be true in order to be religious. Unitarian Universalism lets me keep my spirituality, my faith, and my skepticism, and doesn't ask me to believe in anything but the seven principles, which I firmly hold true." He continues, "I'm not a supporter of the Conservative Party, but many you use in my congregation use derogatory language and insult members of that party. They claim that it's irrational to vote for any party but the leftist ones. I would hope that you use would be more aware and reflective of this open prejudice. It's one of the reasons why I choose never to openly talk about politics in church." End quote. Another Unitarian Universalist from the States talks about being the token Republican in his congregation and being shunned by some of his fellow congregants. He looked up the definition of bigot and found that it pretty well described how some congregants behaved. Quote, "Bigot, a person who is obstinately or intolerantly devoted to his or her own opinions and prejudices, especially one who regards or treats members of a group with hatred and intolerance." End quote. Despite this occasional ill treatment, this Republican UU is committed to our faith and has made good connections here. He says, quote, "As far as political conversations go, I prefer when we discuss the issues. When these conversations are done well, we discover that it is us, all of us, against the problem, and our only differences are our preferred solutions." End quote. In the Beyond the Political Divide workshop, we are asked to consider the following questions. Does talking about politics make you uneasy? If so, why? Do you struggle to talk to people who belong to a different political party than your own? If your congregation became a place where people across the political spectrum were welcome, would you no longer feel welcome? That last one's a tough one. I think a lot of people do fear that welcoming too much political diversity would somehow squeeze them out. So many people come here because they say they enjoy being around like-minded people. It's hard, but I think we can do it, and I think we can grow from it. We've done it with theological diversity. We have a full range here, from mystic theist to agnostic to atheist. We enjoy the richness that comes from learning about one another's different spiritual journeys. I think the same thing can happen with political differences, and not just political, but other differences of opinion about what is right or just. I think we can do it in part because I know at base that everyone here is doing their best to live by our principles. I'm so moved by that earnest striving. It makes me root for all of us. We may have different ideas and opinions, but we're all on the same team. Furthermore, we've each signed on to the principle that supports each individual's right to search for truth and meaning. That's what we're here for. When we are well rested and content enough to be our best selves, we do strive to be open-minded and open-hearted. We believe that richness lies in learning from one another's stories. The authors of Beyond the Partisan Divide advise us that one of the keys to doing this well is to resist our temptation to label others and make assumptions about them based on those labels. They offer an exercise in which two people stand before the group facing each other. We are invited to think of one as an opera fan and the other as a NASCAR fan. I didn't know if Canadians really do NASCAR, so for Canada, we'll say a Calgary oil executive. The group are asked to speak out loud assumptions that each of the two characters might make about the other. For example, someone might say, the opera fan probably has multiple university degrees. They might even say the opera fan is a snob. Someone might say that the oil exec probably drives a gas-guzzling car, or that they don't care about the environment. Each person who speaks an assumption is then invited to come forward and stand between the two main characters. In the end, the group is invited to make observations, and one observation is that the two characters can no longer see each other very well. Their view of one another is obscured by all the assumptions that stand between them. And of course, it's true. Each assumption we make about someone else impedes our ability to see them as they really are. In our UU congregations, we believe in the right of self-definition. We warmly welcome each person to come here as their whole, authentic selves. We lean in and ask with an open-hearted interest, tell us about yourself. And if we are open, we might find that the opera lover did not go to university, but learned to be a mechanic and is not snobby at all. Or we'll learn that the oil exec drives a hybrid and heads up her company's recycling efforts. We are complex beings, all of us. One of the joys of being in this religious community together is listening to each other's stories and learning about those complexities. Recall Larry's conversation with the woman at our place, which dispelled for him a bunch of assumptions commonly made about that community. Perhaps you've had a conversation like that, one that changed your view or widened your perspective. I remember talking with a friend in high school named Asha. Her parents were from Sri Lanka. She was one of the kindest people in our grade. She was a good student, too, smart, responsible, trustworthy. I really liked her. One day, we got to talking about abortion rights. Like most of the people I knew at the time, I was pro-choice. The thought of forcing a woman to carry to term an unwanted pregnancy seemed cruel. I was also swayed by statistics that showed that when abortion was illegal, women got them anyway, in unsanitary and dangerous settings. A situation that was much worse for those with little money. Asha admitted to me that she was pro-life. I was surprised. She didn't fit my stereotype of a pro-lifer at all. She was kind, intelligent, the opposite of self-righteous. She quietly explained that she believed that life begins at conception. To her, it was a baby, and she felt compelled to protect it. I disagreed. I thought the mass of cells formed by sperm and egg in those early stages as a potential for a baby, but not a baby yet. But I understood her point of view for the first time ever. I considered that if a person did think that life begins at conception, I could see how they would want to be against abortion. It didn't change the way I would vote, but it did change the assumptions I made about the other side. I had more compassion for them. I was certainly less likely to dismiss them as stupid or uncaring. That conversation with Asha was so much better than the ones I mentioned earlier that were so frustrating and demoralizing. Perhaps it was because Asha and I were not trying to change each other's minds. We were trying to understand each other. And we did so with love and respect. In this month's Soul Matters theme groups, one of the exercise options is to listen to someone's story. The instructions are, think about an ethical or justice issue about which you feel uncertain or wish to know more. Ask someone who knows about that issue to share with you their views, and this is important, ask them what personal experiences led them to hold those views. Just listen, don't debate. Your goal is to understand this person's thinking and feeling. How did their experience shape their view? This is the kind of listening we're called to do in our congregations. We resist labeling, resist assumptions. We let people define themselves, tell their own stories. It's our job to hold one another in compassion and respect as we each do our best to figure out how to live an ethical life, how to best work toward a just society. And we're going to have different ideas about that. We will disagree on policies in the Middle East, pipeline issues, best parenting practices, congregational budgeting. The authors of the workshop I've been quoting say that our congregations should be sanctuaries in which all can be heard and none are shamed. They remind us that our own Reverend Mark Morrison Reed has warned us that scorn is deadly in religious community. There's a saying that's often repeated in youth circles. Its author is now in question, but our dedication to its meaning is such that the saying persists. We need not think alike to love alike. That sums up the essence of Unitarian Universalism. May we do all that we can to put that ideal into practice. I will close the sermon with a recent example of we need not think alike to live alike, love alike. It's a little bit of an odd example, but it really moved me. You may have heard that the twin daughters of George Bush wrote an open letter to the daughters of Barack Obama. Have you heard about this? Yes, right. As he ended his presidency. I'm guessing that the two sets of daughters had quite different political views. But the letter isn't about that at all. It's warm, heartfelt advice steeped in empathy and encouragement. I'll read just a few excerpts. Malia and Sasha, 8 years ago on a cold November day, we greeted you on the steps of the White House. We saw both the light and wariness in your eyes as you gazed at your new home. Now you are about to join another rarefied club, one of former First Children, a position you didn't seek, and one with no guidelines. Explore your passions. Learn who you are. Make mistakes. You're allowed to. Continue to surround yourself with loyal friends who know you, adore you, and will fiercely protect you. Those who judge you don't love you, and their voices should not hold weight. You have lived through the unbelievable pressure of the White House. You have listened to harsh criticisms of your parents by people who have never even met them. You stood by as your precious parents were reduced to headlines. Your parents, who put you first and who not only showed you but gave you the world. As always, they will be rooting for you as you begin your next chapter. And so will we. We need not think alike to love alike. So may it be for all of us. Our interdependence calls us to love and justice. Let us hold one another in compassion and respect as we each strive to figure out how to best achieve that goal. Let us encourage one another to tell our stories from deep inside and listen with a loving mind. In so doing, may we find that we are better able to be deeply connected, radically inclusive, actively engaged, theologically alive, and spiritually grounded. So may it be. Amen.